across the Confederation border to Plegon for retransmission, but she'd stopped trying to figure it out. She suspected it was partially the Union leader's own genius and partially skilled exploitation of the looseness of Confederation oversight. She scanned the message twice, impressed, as always, by the ingeniousness of the code, which read as though it were personal correspondence for some periphery farmer to distant and more sophisticated relatives on Megara, at least until she introduced the encryption key. She heard a cracking sound and the top of the crate fell to the floor. She looked inside, and she saw a series of neat rows of small devices of some kind, each about 15 centimeters square. "I guess that's what a transport regulator looks like," she thought, worrying for a few seconds that her people had retrieved the wrong packages. But then one of her agents reached in and pulled out the top tray, setting it aside, and revealing the true cargo below. Bars of pure platinum. Most financial transactions were electronic, of course, even most illicit ones, and Villeneuve had sent her significant sums through the normal banking networks. But her mission was a complex one and very dangerous. She had a number of fringe conspirators too scared to accept her normal payoffs. They didn't trust mysterious bank transfers, and it would be helpful to have utterly untraceable currency equivalents for bribes. What they perceived as untraceable, at least. She'd have bet her last credit Villeneuve had arranged for some kind of radioactive tagging, or other way to track the metal bars. The Union's leader didn't trust anyone, as far as she'd ever seen, and certainly not foreign politicians he'd bought and paid for. Any conspirator who took his bribe and betrayed him could expect an unpleasant visit shortly thereafter. She was tense, and she waved for her people to move the crates to the storage area she'd prepared for them. She'd been playing catch-up for the past week. The whole Danith situation had set her back on her primary efforts to undermine the Confederation government. The job had more moving parts than she had expected. There were plenty of willing co-conspirators on Megara, as long as she approached them correctly with the right propositions. Radical political groups, power-hungry politicians, entrenched government officials, wealthy magnates seeking political favor. They could all be induced to take actions that amounted to plotting against the current government, as long as it was presented to them properly. She couldn't exactly go up to the Confeds and say, "Will you help me destabilize the government so the Union can move in?" But she was stunned how receptive different groups were to suggestions about illegal activity, and even downright treason, to further their own positions or pet agendas. She already had demonstrations all across Troia City, the very best protests money could buy. Such activities were just the start. Now her minions were working the other side, the law and order types. They whispered of the need to crack down to restore peace in the streets. Soon, especially after the protests spread further, she looked over at the platinum, which would greatly assist in that endeavor. She would start suggesting remedies like temporary martial law. The magnates would be even easier to co-opt once the scope of her operation spread beyond the capital. Work stoppages on the Iron Belt worlds would trigger harsh reprisals from planetary governments that were largely controlled by the great industrial and merchant families. Such measures had always worked to quell earlier disturbances, but those organic protests hadn't had the funding her manufactured ones would. A few bodies in the streets would help, especially if she could arrange for a couple children, or other particularly sympathetic cases, to be among the apparent victims of government reprisals. On the core worlds, where the government and academic classes were concentrated, the disruptions would move the other way, with groups of radicalized students spreading disorder. The sympathetic authorities would be unwilling to take serious action against the rioters, even as the majority of the population became more restive and resentful. By the time she was done, millions of citizens, even on Megara, would be ready to support a firm hand, one that appeared to step out of nowhere, offering peace and quelling the radicals. Mariellis had worked around the clock for months now, and she had massive numbers of people on her effective payroll, very few of them, save the several hundred operatives she had in the field, knowing exactly for whom they were working. She'd set up dozens of front groups, organizations ranging all across the political spectrum, in some cases operating against each other, a fencing match she'd orchestrated that served to increase the unrest and tension in Megaran society. She was surprised at how much progress she'd made, and at the amount of financial support Villeneuve had managed to send her. Her mission to the Krillians had been conducted on a shoestring, and she'd been forced to substitute lies and theatrics for actual support. The differences she was seeing now were a testament to just how much progress Villeneuve had made in the past 2 years toward restoring the Union economy, or at least finding new ways to drain resources from it. She knew most of the Union systems were still in distress, some deep in outright depressions. But Villeneuve's skilled propaganda had changed everything. Workers who had risen against a government they hated because they were hungry now grimly and determinedly shared the same meager rations as before to support a regime they were convinced would make changes, bring them a brighter and more plentiful future. She wondered how the people of the Union would react if they knew how much of their precious production was being spent on a wild gamble to destabilize the Confederation. She was shocked, too, at how naive the people of the Confederation were, both the politicians immersed in their corruption and the people in the streets, complaining about government and social problems while repeatedly sending the same scoundrels back to political office. She was surprised at how very little difference there was at the core between Confederation politicians and those of the old Union, save perhaps for the range of opportunities for abuse and personal aggrandizement. The common people, for all their material plenty compared to the wretched workers of the Union, were still ready to believe almost anything if it was told to them skillfully, and to ignore even the blatant excesses of the politicians they sent back to the planetary assemblies and the Senate again and again. She hadn't forgotten what Villeneuve had told her right before she'd left Mont-Morale. He'd said that the Confeds talked a lot about freedom, but the instant they felt threatened, or even insecure, they would willingly trade liberty for even the vaguest, most unreliable promises of security. By the time she was done, there would be so much chaos. The people would be clamoring for a strong hand. And she would see they got it. Several, actually, all of whom would fight each other for dominance. The politicians on Megara were held back by the relative stability of the Confederation, by the fact that they had no realistic chance of getting away with the abuses the privileged had enjoyed for so long in the Union. But once she had shattered that stability, she would give them that opportunity, and it would be born from the chaos in the streets. And when she was done, the Confederation would be weakened, or at least changed at its core. And just maybe she could push the whole thing over, and the shining beacon of liberty and freedom on the rim would descend into a vicious orgy of civil war and self-destruction. Chapter 35 CFS Dauntless, Z-11 System, Year 315 AC. Tyler Baron awoke with a start as Sonya Eaton tapped him on the shoulder. "Sir, I'm sorry to disturb you." Her voice was soft, tentative, but he knew immediately something was wrong. And as his senses returned, he realized she'd more than tapped him. She'd given him a good hard shake. That meant she tried gentler methods, both on the comm and standing next to him, to no avail. "What is it, Captain?" he asked, trying hard not to sound as groggy as he felt as he lifted his head from his desk and waited for his eyes to focus. He hadn't intended to sleep, just to put his head down and close his eyes for a few minutes, but now he caught the chronometer and realized that had been nearly 4 hours before. He felt a burst of self-recrimination, and he wondered if he'd have allowed himself to fall asleep at his desk when he was younger. He hadn't realized what the war with the Union had drained from him. But now, with the prospect of a new conflict, he wondered if he could serve as he had before, to give all, and to stand by and issue orders as he watched so many of his people die. He wondered if his grandfather had experienced similar feelings. The Elder Baron had been a legend, one whose martial brilliance had been almost single-handedly responsible for bringing the Confederation back from the brink of defeat. But that had been during the Second War with the Union. Baron's namesake had died in the Third War, his ship trapped by a Union strike force and destroyed. Tyler had never considered that his grandfather's death could have been caused to some extent by fatigue, by the fact that he hadn't been able to enter a Third War with the energy and determination he'd brought to the First. At least he'd never considered it until now. Baron's head was heavy, his thoughts still foggy. He'd been trying to hold off taking another stim. He could feel the effects of the ones he'd been sucking down like candy over the past few days, and he suspected he was going to need more of them in the near future. But still, 4 hours of sleep seemed like an irresponsible decadence. "It's Captain Horace, sir. He sent his cutter back through the transit point with a communique for you." Eden paused for a few seconds. "It is designated classified. Your eyes only, sir." Baron wondered why Horace would classify a report, but then he remembered what a hard-ass the old officer was. He could only think of one thing that could be in the transmission, and if it was what he guessed, it was time to make a final decision. I guess old Ramrod Horace figured I'd want to make that myself, or at least get a head start before half the fleet offered opinions. I'll listen to it here. He reached out, fumbling around on his desk, still trying to get the sleep out of his head. Eaton leaned forward and tapped at the controls of the comm unit, taking over for his rough efforts. On your headset, sir? No, put it on speaker, Captain. There was no one else in the room but Eaton himself, and she was doing a damn fine job of filling in for Atara Travis. He'd never have kept anything from Atara, and he wasn't going to do it from Eaton either. He needed at least one close confidant, an aide, a friend he could trust to give him an honest opinion. Sit, Captain. Listen in. He suspected they both knew what Horace's transmission would say. Baron flipped the switch and activated the comm unit.
Admiral Baron, we have detected enemy forces emerging from this system's gamma transit point.
At least the gamma point is on the other side of the system. We should have a couple days before they can reach us here.
I, unfortunately, have limited scanning information at this range. As I send this transmission, ships are still emerging.
Horace hesitated, which sent a chill down Baron's spine. He'd never known his old instructor to be unnerved by anything.
And we are picking up several large contacts, Admiral. We can't get exact mass readings this far out, but my best guess is the biggest ship substantially outmassed Dauntless and the other Repulse-class battleships.
The words hit Baron like a bat. This new enemy, the Hegemony they called themselves, had superior technology, and now it seemed also ships larger than the Confederation's biggest. He looked up, his eyes finding Eaton's. He could see the shock in her expression, and he knew she was thinking the same thing he was. He felt the urge to flee, to issue a fleet order and bolt for the transit point leading back to the Confederation. There were reasons to run, besides whatever role the natural desire for survival was playing in his thoughts. Megara had to be warned. The Confederation faced a grave new threat, and Admiral Stryker and the others needed to know as soon as possible what the White Fleet had found. It all made sense, until he thought about leaving his people on the surface. There was no coldly rational argument to make that a consideration. A few hundred people were nothing compared to the tens of thousands in the fleet, or the billions back in the Confederation. But Atara's face was there in his thoughts, resolutely staring up at the sky, almost as if she could see the fleet leaving, abandoning her and the others to the enemy's mercy. But he was the fleet's commander and the Confederation's senior representative first, and Atara Travis's friend second. It had to be that way, and she would have been the first one to scold him if he ever forgot that. But that perspective hardly offered clarity. Warning the Confederation was essential, but that wouldn't take the whole fleet. He could send dispatches back to Megara and still stand and fight. The Confederation was a peaceful nation, in its ideals if not in its actual history. But there was little cause for optimism with this new adversary. If they truly considered themselves to be superior to all other groups of humans, was there any chance for peace? And do I dare show fear in front of them? Weakness? He remembered Globus's words at the meeting, the Alliance commander's urgings that the fleet must present a show of strength. He'd discounted the argument as Palatian bluster when he'd first heard it. But now he remembered his mission 7 years before, the deadly trip the old Dauntless had taken to Santis to meet an invader, and to show strength in a situation where weakness would invite invasion and war. His people had fought a desperate battle there, and sent the only message to the Palatians that they could understand. The strength his people had shown at such terrible cost had prevented a war, and led years later to the Confederation-Palatian alliance, turning an enemy into a friend. From what he'd seen so far of the Hegemony, he doubted a show of strength, no matter how firm, would prevent a conflict. But it just might delay it. If the fleet turned tail and ran, the enemy might pursue. They might push forward to the rim at once and invade the Confederation immediately. If Baron could hurt the enemy here, show them that the Confederation would be no easy conquest, perhaps he could buy time. The Hegemony seemed utterly convinced of its superiority, but Baron had seen no signs of the codes of honor or martial traditions that so shaped the Alliance and sometimes led the Palatians into foolish endeavors. If he could hit them hard enough, give them a bloody nose, maybe they would pause. That just might give Admiral Stryker enough time to get all the demobilized ships back into service, and get word to Vian Tullis. He was sure the Alliance's new Imperator would take his warning seriously, and send the battered remnants of the Palatian fleet to fight alongside the Confederation forces.
If we can just buy enough time. He'd been listening to the rest of Horace's report, mostly numbers of ships, estimated masses, and notes on the formation. The officer was perhaps the hardest Baron had ever known, and also one of the most meticulous. Baron wasn't sure all the information was helpful, but he never remembered a combat situation where he'd suffered for having too much knowledge. Still, he reached out and turned off the comm. He'd heard all he needed to hear for now. And he'd made a decision. Captain, sending communications drone back to the transit point. Kraken is to return to the system at once. Instruct Captain Horace to launch all his remaining drones first, with programming to send one back every 2 hours, and also as the enemy fleet hits any range bands he feels are significant.
Yes, sir.
Eden stood up abruptly, turning to move toward the door. Sonia?
Sir?
As soon as you send the drone, I want you to get the task force commanders on the fleet comm. He'd order the fleet formation condensed, and most of the ships were now within reasonable comm distance of Dauntless. There were still some outliers, and the communications would be difficult and cumbersome to an extent, but he had to talk to his commanders. Immediately.
Yes, sir.
He could hear defiance in her voice, building, pushing back against the fear. He leaned back and watched her leave, and then he let out a long, deep exhale. He too felt his determination growing, the anger at these people and their attitudes, at the way they treated the natives of Planet Zero, and how they ignored his every effort to seek a peaceful solution.
Admiral. That quickly Eaton's voice was on the comm.
All commanders on fleet comm now, sir, awaiting your transmission.
Very well, he said, his hand moving toward the controls, pausing for a few seconds above the switch, thinking about what he wanted to say. The time for discussion had passed. His words now were for those who served him, to rally them for the fight, to awaken the warriors he knew lived inside each of them. The fleet was going to prepare for battle, and he was going to make damn sure everyone was ready, from his highest commanders to the stewards drafted into damage control duties. They weren't going to turn around and run. He'd shown strength once before in a similar situation, perhaps on a vastly smaller scale than the battle that loomed in front of him here. But still, the memory nagged at him. He knew what might have happened if Dauntless had run at Santis, if he'd shown weakness rather than strength to an alliance ready to strike. No, he wasn't going to run. He wasn't going to abandon his people on the surface, and he damn sure wasn't going to do anything to feed the notions of superiority the masters of the hegemony so clearly felt. If they were so much more capable, they could show him. They could take on all the White Fleet had to give, the sweat and blood of its battle-hardened ships and veteran crew, and then they could see how their theories of genetic superiority held up. He didn't know if his people could win, but he was damn sure they would put up one hell of a fight. And whatever happened, they would give the hegemony's forces a taste of what awaited them if they invaded the Confederation. Chapter 36. Planet Zero. Z-11 System. Year 315 AC. Stu Weldon turned to the side and stumbled, reaching out and grabbing at the table in a fruitless effort to stay his fall. He landed hard on the ground, dropping the canister he'd been holding. Travis jumped up from the chair she'd been sitting in and pulled the needle from her arm, wincing slightly as she did. She raced across the room and bent down over the doctor.
"Stu, are you all right?"
"Just a little dizzy."
His words were soft, slurred. She could see he was barely conscious. He looked up at her.
"Stim."
She shook her head.
"You just had one an hour ago. You saw the test results."
Weldon had done the quick scan on himself, checking the damage he'd done by shooting up on industrial-strength stims for as long as he had. The results were grim. There was no way to be sure which would be the dosage that would kill him. It might be the next, or the third or fourth after that, but it wouldn't be much longer.
"Going to die anyway. Gotta keep going."
Travis was resistant at first, her thoughts fixed on protecting the doctor, her friend, from himself. But Weldon's logic was unfortunately flawless. He needed the stims because of the disease that was killing him, and in the end it really didn't matter which did the job first. At least if he kept going, there was a chance, however vanishing, that he might succeed at his seemingly impossible job. Travis finally nodded, making herself a bit lightheaded as well. She'd given Weldon as much blood as he'd been willing to take. The doctor, despite the grim fate that awaited him, and all the others who were still clinging to life, had refused to allow her to endanger herself, at least beyond a little dizziness.
"Okay,"
she said, still not feeling great about it. She reached over to the table, pulling up the injector and checking to make sure it held another dose. She paused for a few seconds, unsure if Weldon was going to get up and inject himself, but the doctor just lay where he was, looking almost like he was in a stupor. She reached down, holding the injector, and stopped just short of his arm. She didn't want to do it. She was well aware it could kill Weldon, and she had no idea of the lasting health effects of such abuse of very powerful stimulants. But the facts remained. Unless he could make this new serum work and do it quickly, he was as good as dead. He'd sent his findings up to the fleet, of course, and she didn't doubt the med teams were working feverishly there, but they didn't have her blood, and she was the only one in the landing party who had not fallen ill. She shoved the injector against his upper arm and heard the click as the tiny needles shot into his flesh, giving the dying doctor yet another 10 cc's of the potent drug. He sat where he was, almost still for perhaps 15 or 20 seconds as his energy returned. Then he stood up, clearly still struggling with the soreness she knew was affecting every muscle in his body. He'd refused painkillers, wanting to stay as sharp as he could. He propped himself up in his arms, leaning on the desk for a few seconds, and taking 2 or 3 deep breaths. Then he reached out and picked up a small vial. He slid it into a machine sitting on the table and flipped a switch. A clear liquid from a second container poured into the vial, and the machine shook the container, thoroughly mixing the two substances. He turned and looked over at Travis. "Well, Atara, this should be it. I followed the same procedure I did before, only this time with your blood. If this doesn't work, I'm afraid it's over. I have no idea where else to go from here." Travis felt her stomach tighten. The idea of watching everyone in the landing party die, including Weldon, was upsetting. But there was something else there, too, and she was ashamed by it. She thought about herself, about being stuck on the planet after the rest of the landing party was gone, along with only the locals, and the master she knew she couldn't watch around the clock. Even now, she had 2 very sick Marines watching him, but it wouldn't be long before he could simply walk out of the hut where she had him confined. What would he do? Order the locals to tear her to pieces? She wasn't sure how that would go. They seemed as intimidated by her and the rest of the landing party as by the master. But she wasn't anxious to find out. "But you will, if Weldon's serum doesn't work. You know you can't go back. There's no proof you're truly immune, and even if you are, you have no idea if you can carry this plague back with you even though you're not sick. It will tear Tyler apart, but he'll have to leave you here, alone." She tried to use shame to drive the thoughts from her mind, but they remained nevertheless. The idea of being marooned in such a strange and alien place terrified her as none of the deadly battles she fought ever had. It was taking all she had to maintain her control, to hold back the panic trying to take her. "Yes, tell your dying friend that you're upset because you'll be stuck here alone after he's dead. Pull yourself together, Atara." "Well, we'd better see if it works." She glanced down at the table for a few seconds. "Are you sure you want to test it on yourself? We could bring in one of the others if..."
"It has to be me, Atara, for the same reason as before. If it works, I'll have to find a way to make more, somehow. I've got maybe 12 doses here, but we're going to need a lot more than that."
He left unspoken. That meant he would need more of her blood. A lot more. And quickly. She just nodded. There was no use worrying about how much blood she could give, not until they knew the serum worked. She stood and watched as Weldon took the injector and moved it toward himself. He paused for a moment and looked over at Travis.
"Whatever happens, Atara, thank you for your assistance. Thanks for everything."
Travis wanted to answer, but all she could manage was a nod, and a mostly successful effort to hold back the tears trying to well up in her eyes. Weldon had been Dauntless's chief medical officer from the day she and Baron had set foot on the now legendary vessel. He'd become a close friend since then, one of the very few she had, and now she knew she would see if he'd managed to create a miracle of sorts, or if she was going to have to watch him die on this shithole planet. He managed to give her a frail smile, and then he injected himself with the drug.
"Commander Globus reports his ships are in position, Admiral."
Sonya Eaton was at her chair in the control center. Baron was looking over, watching her lean forward, somehow keeping track of nearly 6 screens, feeding her information on the fleet deployment and progress. Her own job was an immense load, but now she was doing everything Atara would have handled as well, except for actually commanding Dauntless. Baron himself had taken on that responsibility, and he felt a little guilty for how anxious he was to wear that hat with Atara trapped down on the surface. The magnificent new battleship wasn't his, Dauntless, and he'd sworn she never could be. But he'd come to appreciate the new vessel. She might not be the ship he'd always remember as his first command, but she was a fitting successor.
She's not your successor. She's Atara's ship. You're just standing in.
Very well, Captain. Baron might have been amused at how quickly Globus had gotten his Alliance forces ready for the fight that was coming. The veteran commander was a very intelligent man. Baron had seen that firsthand, and a reasonable one, too, at times. But he had the weakness for battle that was so ingrained in his people. The hegemony had attacked first, and to Globus, their conduct was an insult to the fleet. Baron had come to know his Alliance comrades very well, and if he'd learned one thing, it was, don't insult a Palatian. Not unless you're looking for a fight to the death. He glanced down at his own comm unit, thinking he should talk to Fritz before the enemy arrived. The primary duty of her new role had been to analyze any old tech the fleet found, but instead of piles of artifacts, the expedition had stumbled onto something it hadn't wanted or expected, a new enemy. Anya Fritz could do the most good now by taking personal charge of the flagship's damage control, and hopefully keeping the big ship going for as long as possible, just as she had on the old Dauntless. He was about to reach down to the unit when the lift doors opened, and none other than Captain Anya Fritz stepped out into the control room. Baron looked with a start. He couldn't remember Fritz ever setting foot on the old Dauntless's bridge, though he was sure she must have upon occasion. She'd always considered the engineering sections to be her domain, and save from moving around from one damaged section of the ship to another, she generally stayed within those invisible borders. "Fritzy, I was just about to calm you. I want you to take over Dauntless's engineering teams during the battle. There's not much you can do fleet-wide in the middle of a fight, so let's focus your magic on this ship."
"Yes, sir, of course. I just assumed I would do that."
She was right, of course. She was in command of engineering operations fleet-wide, which meant she could assign herself to Dauntless. But there was something else on her mind, too. He wasn't sure what, but she seemed edgy. "Is there something wrong, Fritzy?"
"No, sir. We just had an idea, and I..."
She hesitated. "We, Fritzy? Who's we?"
"Well, sir..."
"Admiral, I've got Commodore Eaton on your line." Baron turned his head. It always seemed a bit surprising to him when Sonya Eaton referred to her sister so impersonally. Both of the Eatons were consummate professionals, and he'd be the first one to sing either of their praises. He glanced back at Fritz.
"Put her on speaker, Captain."
"Admiral."
"Yes, Commodore, I'm here with Captain Fritz. What is it?"
"I was talking with
Captain Fritz earlier, and..."
"And clearly the two of you are plotting something, so one of you come out already and say it."
"We want to mine the space just this side of the transit point, Admiral,"
Eaton blurted out. Fritz was standing in the same spot, nodding. Baron looked at Fritz for a second, and then he adjusted the microphone on his headset.
"We haven't used mines in 50 years.
He found that he wasn't sure whether to say Commodore or Captain, so he didn't finish the sentence. Mines had been a key weapon half a century earlier, one that had been extensively used to defend transit points against assault. But the Confederation had developed methods for sending out pulses from their ships that detonated the mines before a ship reached them. And it had taken Sector 9 less than a year to steal that knowledge for Union use. Within a decade, every Rim nation possessed the countermeasures to battle minefields, using the same technology that had rendered missiles ineffective in space combat.
"Sir," Fritz said nervously, "this is only a guess, but just because we developed the technology to deal with mines doesn't mean these people have. We don't know much about the masters."
She said the word with considerable distaste in her tone.
"But it's a reasonable guess that, living so close to the center of the cataclysm, they haven't had to deal with as many surviving neighbors as we have, or the number of desperate wars we've fought. Struggles like that are a catalyst for weapons development, one they might have lacked."
"But their technology is ahead of ours."
"Yes, Admiral, but that doesn't mean they developed all the same things we have."
It was Eaton this time, and Fritz nodded as the Commodore spoke. "We only developed our anti-mine tech because of our constant wars against the Union. If we'd been at peace for the past century, we might have developed different things, but we'd probably never have even researched countermeasures for theoretical minefields."
Baron understood what his two officers were saying, but he still wasn't convinced.
"But their technology is clearly sufficient to develop the same countermeasures we did."
"Yes, sir," Fritz said, "but not before this coming battle. We're not suggesting we have a long-term edge against the Masters, but we just might have a way to get a jump here and now."
Baron was beginning to agree.
and he was ready to take any advantage he could get. But we don't have mines. As far as I know, the Confederation hasn't produced any in more than 40 years.
I cobbled some together.
Fritz stood where she was, but she didn't look directly at Baron. You what?
Well, Admiral, you did put me in charge of fleet engineering, and we do have a lot of extra equipment, especially on the supply ships.
She paused.
I managed to put 120 mines together. Not enough for a proper field, but the way I see it, the way Commodore Eaton and I see it, any of those ships we can take out or even damage is worth the effort.
Baron looked back at his engineer, amazed not at her suggestion, but that somehow despite all the miracles he'd seen her perform, he still managed to underestimate her sometimes. Do it, Fritzy, and Commodore. He paused, holding back a smile the best he could. Fritzy, you get those mines ready to go. If we're going to get them in place before the enemy transits into the system, we don't have much time. Sarah, this is your idea too, so you figure out the positioning. Put them wherever you think they'll do the most good.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
The two answered almost simultaneously. Then get it done. He turned and shook his head, once again grateful for the people he had around him.
Why is it always you?
Stara Sinclair almost always kept her emotions in check, but not now. Stockton had expected her to like his plan, but he was surprised when she blew up at him. She'd calmed down some since then, but she was still clearly upset. You know why it's me, Stara. Stockton understood her reaction. At least he thought he did. He didn't suspect it was easy to be in a relationship with him, especially considering his reputation for what people had charitably described as craziness. He'd been wild as a younger pilot, even he could admit that. But he'd grown out of that, and had been promoted above it, too. It had been 2 years since he'd done anything more dangerous than flying around in training missions. Then suddenly he realized. Stara had been steeled up to face the realities of war back then, but the new threat was just sinking in. She didn't have her defenses up, and the idea of him blasting through the transit point to stand alone before an entire attacking fleet, slipping away only at the last second, was too much for her to accept. But she didn't have a choice. Stockton had told Admiral Baron he would do it, and that was the last word as far as he was concerned. Even if he hadn't promised the Admiral, he understood the threat menacing the fleet, the danger the entire Confederation and all of its neighbors faced. He agreed with Baron and with the Palatians. The best thing the fleet could do was give this new enemy a bloody nose. Hopefully it would make them rethink things, bring them to the bargaining table, and even if it didn't, it might give them pause, buy some time. His mission was the best way to accomplish that, maybe the only way. Close-in transit point defenses were rare in war, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which was, without knowing an attacking fleet's vector and velocity, it was impossible to place defensive ships. A force could deploy right at the point, only to watch a fleet come through at 1/100th the speed of light and zip past and out of range in a matter of seconds. But Stockton could scan the approaching fleet, and the longer he stayed, the closer he cut it, the better and more accurate his nav information would be when he zipped back into Z-11 and sent his report to the fleet. Stara fell silent as the two walked down the corridor and out onto the landing bay. She'd argued with him, but even when she'd been most upset, he was sure she knew he had to go. She was as much a veteran as he was, and she knew the stakes just as well. It hurt him to see how worried she was, how much his mission was hurting her. It was a long, unanswered question. What's worse, going into danger, or waiting to see if a loved one returns? He didn't pretend, even to himself, that he had any great wisdom in such matters. But he knew that mystery didn't apply here, not really. Stara wouldn't be safe on some well-protected planet somewhere. She'd be at her station on Dauntless, going into battle with the rest of the fleet. And he was damned committed to do whatever he could to help the fleet gain an edge, help Dauntless and Stara make it through. I'll be back. I'm always back. He'd said such things all his life, but now it even sounded hollow to him. He'd seen too many people die. One day he suspected he would leave after spewing that kind of bluster, and he wouldn't come back. But that's not this time, he told himself. If he didn't get back, he couldn't report, and if he didn't report, Baron wouldn't know where to position his ships. He stopped next to his fighter, scanning it quickly, his eyes going to the modification the engineering teams had quickly made. She was like a bird he'd flown once before on an even longer mission. She carried twice the fuel of a normal Lightning, and a host of extra scanning and communications gear. All that came at a cost, though, and in this case, that was weapons. All of them, even the targeting computer. He was going to fly his fighter and hold his ground right in front of the enemy fleet, and he wouldn't have a laser hot enough to light a candle. He turned toward Stara. "I'll be back." He almost said, "I promise," but he had enough of the pilot's superstition left in him to hold back, not to tempt fortune's wrath. "I love you," he finally said softly. She looked back at him, her face still, clearly struggling to hold back her emotions. "I love you too," she said. "I'll take you through the launch sequence." Then she just turned and left, heading back to the control center. Stockton watched her go, just for a few seconds. Then he turned and climbed up the ladder, hopping into his cockpit. He regretted the fact that the fleet had found a new enemy, that the peace his comrades had enjoyed for 2 years had been shattered. But as he sat in the confines of the fighter, waiting for Star's voice to come on the comm, he had a thought, one he found disturbing, but also one he knew was true. It felt like home. Chapter 37. Cellar of a nondescript warehouse. Spacer District, just off the promenade. Port Royal City, Planet Danith, Ventica 3. 315 AC. Andy felt pressure against the skin on her arm. Devices like the injector were normally painless, but her captors had worked her over so many times that every square millimeter of her body was sore. The tiny pinpricks only inflamed the pain she'd been feeling more or less constantly for weeks now, and she cried out, hating herself for giving the bastards the satisfaction. She was ready to tell them whatever they wanted to know to get them to stop, even without the drug, and that realization had obliterated her sense of self-worth. She'd like to believe she was unbreakable, that no enemy could shatter her will to resist, but now she only wished she had something, anything to tell them, just to end the torment, even though she doubted they'd stop even then. None of that really mattered anymore, except to feed her self-loathing. She didn't know anything, at least nothing they seemed to be after. The pain in her arm spread, and she realized it was the drug moving through her bloodstream. It wouldn't kill her, she was sure enough of that, but Lié's words echoed in her head, and she imagined herself a vegetable, or a meek, useless shell of what she'd been. Better to die. Far better. She regretted that she hadn't fought back harder when she'd had the strength, forced her captors to kill her. But then that would have been a form of surrender, too, at least while there had still been a chance for her to escape, or for Gary Holston to find her. Even as she thought of Holston, she heard sounds, banging at first and then gunfire. She was dreaming, she was sure of it, imagining the rescue attempt she'd waited and hoped for. But she didn't believe it anymore. Her captors were too good. Ricard Lié was the best Sector 9 had. I guess I should feel honored. There was more gunfire now, some kind of automatic weapon and then an explosion, one that sent a cloud of dust dropping from the room's low ceiling. For an instant she was confused, surprised at how real her dream seemed to be. And then she realized, it's real. There's some kind of fight going on. She opened her eyes, tried to focus. Everything was a blur. She'd been in bad enough shape, but now she could feel the drug taking hold. Even as she realized there was a battle in progress all around her, that perhaps Holston's people had finally found her, she felt herself slipping from reality, her perceptions drifting away. She tried to fight it, but she found herself giving in, wanting to yield, to escape the pain. She struggled through the pain to pull herself back, to hang on to what little remained of herself. She closed her eyes tightly, then opened them again and squinted, trying to see what was happening. The sounds of fighting were louder now, closer, and she could see the agent in the room with her, staring at the stairs leading up from the cellar where she'd been held. Lié. Her eyes caught her tormentor, ducking through a small door, barely a meter high. An escape route. No, you don't get away. You don't survive, bastard. But she knew there was nothing she could do, even as her hatred for Lié gave her flagging energy a boost. She was still looking when he turned around and gestured to one of the men standing in the room. "Kill her," he said. The words echoed in her ears, in her mind. She could barely keep her thoughts functioning, to see through the pain, but she'd heard Lié's command, and she knew what it meant. She tried to get up, to lunge toward her captors, her executioners, but there was nothing. Her legs wouldn't move, nor her arms. The drug had her almost paralyzed. All she could do was shift her head to the side, enough to see the arm of one of the men rising and the pistol it held. She struggled to move, to force her body forward in a last lunge at her killers. She wanted to die as a fighter, resisting to the last, not an animal led to slaughter. But her muscles didn't respond, and she sat frozen in helpless agony as the man pointed his pistol and fired. She heard the gunshot, but she didn't feel anything. She waited for her body to fall, for the pain, for the blood pouring out of her, for death to take her. But then there was another shot, and another. Still nothing. She just sat where she was, paralyzed, and watching as her would-be killer fell forward, landing face down, his gun skittering across the floor. There were more shots now, automatic fire, and all around the room she could see shadows, and then people, figures dressed in some kind of combat fatigues with heavy body armor. Soldiers of some kind. No, those are Confederation Marines. She felt herself slipping away, the drug sapping what remained of her strength. She tried desperately to cling to consciousness, to call out to whoever was attacking her captors. But there was nothing left. Nothing but the growing darkness. Gary Holston stood in the hospital room looking down at the figure in the bed. He'd always liked Andy LaFarge and respected her, too. Her independence, her drive, the raw intelligence that was so much stronger than most people knew. She was as close to him as anyone was, save perhaps Van Stryker. And he was aware just how important she was to another of his most important friends, Tyler Barron. He'd recruited her because he trusted her, both her loyalty and her ability to handle any crisis she encountered. She'd been up against danger most of her adult life, and Holston had truly believed he could keep her safe on Danith. But he hadn't expected the Union's intelligence agency to have recovered so quickly. And he certainly hadn't bargained with Andy meeting an adversary like Ricard Lié almost immediately after arriving on Danith. Holston knew Lié. At least he knew of the Sector 9 killer. Lié was Gaston Villeneuve's right hand, and based on what little intel Holston had managed to gather on the mysterious assassin, the two men were actually friends. He still believed Andy could have handled almost any agent she was up against, but Lié was something entirely different. For all her adventures and the fights and dangers she'd faced, Andy was new to espionage, and Ricard Lié was, by all accounts, the very best on either side. He was still watching her, as he had been for hours now, when she finally stirred. She was hurt, badly. Broken ribs, a shattered ulna, internal bleeding, a ruptured lung, more contusions than he could easily count. The list went on and on. But all of that was treatable. It was the drug that worried him, the one they had given her. It had wreaked havoc on her system, and for a while he had worried there would be brain damage. But the doctors, and he'd rounded up every surgeon and physician on Danith worth the name, bringing some of them to the hospital along with a marine escort, had assured him they'd intervened in time. She would be groggy and there would be more pain. But she would recover. Completely. He was relieved. But looking at her, he still had trouble believing it, and whatever the long-term prognosis, he knew his friend had an extended and painful recovery ahead of her. And he knew it was his fault.
Gary.
Her voice was thin, labored. She looked up at him, her eyes cloudy, unfocused. I'm here, Andy. He tried to sound strong, to keep the regret and sadness from his words. She didn't need that now. She needed a hand she trusted, one that could lead her back. The doctors might save her life, bring her back to physical health, but Holston had seen enough broken, tortured agents to know that Andy faced other challenges. She would need support, people she trusted and who cared about her. Most of all, she suspected she would need Tyler Barron. But he had been one of the prime movers in sending Barron hundreds of light years away. It would be months before he returned, even years.
Thanks. For rescuing me.
He could see her trying to move her head up, extend her arm toward him, but she gave up and let both drop back to the bed, wincing in pain. You have to take it easy, Andy. You're going to be all right, as good as new. He wondered if his words were empty, or if he truly believed she was strong enough to find her way back. He was scared for her, but he knew better than to bet against Andy LaFarge. You're going to have to rest.
Tyler?
Holston sighed softly. He's with the White Fleet, Andy. You remember? She looked confused for a moment, but then she nodded, or at least something close to a small nod.
White Fleet? Yes, I remember.
And you're going to be in the hospital for a while, but I don't want you to worry about anything. He turned and gestured to an armed woman in combat dress and armor, standing just inside the door. There will be a squad of Marines on duty here and outside your room around the clock. No one will hurt you again. She looked at Holston, and he could see her eyes were a little brighter than they'd been.
Thank you, Gary.
Then she stared at him for a few seconds, a look of clarity replacing the confused expression she'd worn since she'd awakened.
Not your fault.
He appreciated her words, but they cut through him like a knife as well. She was absolving him, but if it hadn't been for him, she'd still be on Telluris in her big, beautiful villa. She might be bored, but she wouldn't be lying in bed, battered to death's door, and no doubt struggling with memories he couldn't even imagine. He would feel guilty for recruiting her for as long as he lived, and his only solace was that he had done everything necessary to save her, whatever the eventual cost. Even as he thought about it, he heard a commotion out in the hall. He knew what it was, or at least he had a good idea, and he didn't think Andy needed to see it. I'll be back to check on you later, Andy. He leaned down and kissed her on the forehead. You get some rest, and don't worry about anything. No one can get to you here. She managed a thin smile, all the response he needed. Then he turned around and walked out into the hall. The Marines in Andy's detail were standing in front of the door, tense, holding their weapons but not pointing them at anyone. Yet, they had formed a rough line, one that included Colonel Peterson, he realized. Facing them were other uniformed personnel, Port Royal City Police. And behind the police, most of whom carried heavy riot gear, were Walter Aguilar and his collection of Troyes City parasites. The senatorial aide wore an obnoxious smile, one Holston desperately wanted to slap off his face. You're under arrest, Mr. Holston, for the offenses listed in this Senate order and for your efforts in resisting apprehension. You will come with me now. My orders are very clear. I am to bring you to Megara to answer the charges against you. Holston felt his defiance rising. He was about to hurl an insult at the sleazy piece of shit when Peterson beat him to it. Mr. Holston is under our protection. His tone was hard, cold. Everything a fop like Aguilar probably expected and likely feared from a veteran warrior like Peterson. Do not interfere, Colonel, Aguilar managed to say, making a partially successful effort to hide the fear in his voice. This doesn't concern you. The hell it doesn't, you useless piece of Troyes City garbage. Peterson arched back, and though it hadn't seemed possible, he stood up straighter than he had been. He was almost a full head taller than Aguilar. His hand was at his side, resting on the holster that held what Holston could only imagine was a well-worn pistol. Aguilar looked queasy, as though he might throw up any moment, but the aide impressed Holston by only taking one step back. Captain, prepare your officers. It was another voice. Holston could see the man standing behind the police, and he recognized him immediately. Stanford Beresford, the president of the Danith Planetary Assembly, and a politician who'd spent every waking moment over the past weeks railing against the blockade and the Marines bashing down doors all over the planet. The police looked nervous, and Holston could see most of them looking over at the Marines. But one by one, they drew their weapons. Marines at the ready! Peterson's voice was crisp, his tone in every way that of a combat veteran. Jonathan Peterson had fought against Foudre Rouge. Holston didn't imagine the Marine was the slightest bit intimidated by a bunch of local cops and senatorial lapdog guards, even if they outnumbered his people by better than 2-1. I'm warning you, Colonel, you have one last chance to stand down, or I'll have you arrested as well. Holston was surprised at Aguilar's burst of courage, and he winced instinctively, having some idea what the Marine's response would be. You listen to me, you pamper piece of garbage. You may think you're a tough guy coming here with your bullshit orders in this crowd of enforcers, but you ain't got nothing more than a mob fit to scold a bunch of kids on a playground. My Marines have seen things that would make you wet the pants of that fancy suit you've got on. Aguilar stood silently for a moment. Holston suspected the senatorial errand boy was trying to steal up his courage, to convince himself Confederation Marines would never open fire on a group of local police and a representative of the Senate. Holston might have thought that too, but he knew Peterson well, and he wasn't so sure anymore. It's up to you. What's it gonna be? Peterson raised his hand, and the Marines brought their rifles up, not quite aiming at the police, but definitely at the ready. Holston was gratified that his friend would go so far to protect him. He didn't doubt the 10 Marines could wipe out the 24 or so police and lictors, and probably in 3 seconds without taking any losses. At least losses on the spot. But such an action would be treason. They'd lose their careers, and that would be just the start. They would probably spend the rest of their lives in the stockade. John Peterson might even mount the scaffold. Holston was grateful, to his friend, to the Marines. But he couldn't be the reason Confederation Marines clashed with civilian law enforcement personnel. It was hard to even imagine the damage that would do to the Confederation, to the delicate balance that made the whole thing work when every other nation on the rim embraced some form of total or partial autocracy. He'd done what he had to do for Andy. But she was safe now. And as defiant as he'd always been, he wasn't ready to be the reason the Confederation military killed Confederation civilians. "No, John, stand your Marines down." He paused, taking a shallow breath. "I'll go with them." "Gary, you can't. It's okay, John. Don't worry. Getting me back to Megara isn't the end of the story, I can promise you that." He thought of the files he had, the dirt on members of the Senate. They were vile creatures, many of them, and they didn't deserve to hold the high offices they did. And if they pushed this too far, more than a few of them will lose those positions they lied and cheated and stole to get. "Stand down, my friend, please." Holston turned toward Peterson and forced a smile. "Please, John." The colonel hesitated, but finally he nodded to Holston, and then he put out a hand, lowering it. The Marines brought their rifles down, holding them at their sides. "These Marines are not to get so much as a note in their files." Holston's eyes were fixed on Aguilar's. Even as a man about to become a prisoner, Holston's force of will rushed over the aide with the power of a tidal wave. "We only want you. As long as these Marines stand down, we have no interest in them." "Then I will come." He turned and looked back toward Peterson. "John, do one thing for me. Watch out for Andy, please." "I will, Gary." Peterson's voice was somber, as emotional as Holston had ever heard it. He'd always considered the Marine to be a friend, but he realized now there were certain times in life when you found out just who you could count on when you most needed help. Holston would never forget Colonel Jonathan Peterson was firmly in that group. "All right, let's go," he said to Aguilar, making sure his voice showed as little respect as possible. "Some of the people who sent you here are in for a rude awakening when I get back to Troyes City." Chapter 38. 10,000 kilometers from Transit Point Alpha. Z-12 system. Year 315 AC. Stockton sat in the cockpit, twisting his body to the side, trying to work out the kinks. He'd been in his fighter for almost 16 hours, which was nothing compared to the great multi-system journey he'd made years before. But it was still enough to get really uncomfortable. Stockton had fought in more battles than he could easily count, but he still remembered that very long flight as the most challenging thing he'd ever done. Lightnings weren't designed for such long-duration missions, and the assortment of modifications needed to provide sufficient life support and fuel, not to mention addressing food needs and the accommodation of bodily functions, were extensive. He'd been watching the hegemony fleet moving toward the transit point, recording every move, every burst of thrust. Maybe someone back on Dauntless could make something of it all in terms of estimating enemy capabilities. It was clear enough just watching that the enemy had greater thrust capability than the Confederation vessels. That would be a strong edge in any fight, and combined with their longer-ranged weapons, it laid a major problem at Admiral Barron's feet. "But if they really don't have fighters, that's an edge for us." His thoughts had looped around, various versions of this kind of logic moving in and out of his mind. The topic wasn't nearly interesting enough to really make the hours go by, but it was better than seeing how many consecutive seconds he could count before his mind wandered. He reached out, poking at the controls on his panel, double-checking his status. The AI had done it already, but he was happier checking himself. First, it gave him something to do. And second, he would need everything his fighter could give him when it was time to sprint back to the transit point. He had brought a drone with him into Z-12, though he still wasn't sure how Anya Fritz had managed to attach the thing to his fighter. He'd sent it back a couple hours before with most of the data the fleet would need. His purpose now was to stay in position and monitor any changes in enemy dispositions prior to transit. At least he wouldn't have the drone hanging off his ship on the way back. His fighter had handled like shit with that thing hanging off it, and the trip back would have a lot less room for error. His eyes moved to the screen, watching as the approaching ships came closer. They didn't seem to be decelerating much, which probably meant they were going to come through at a relatively high velocity. That made sense. It was a precaution against a transit point defense on the other side. At least it was if the defenders didn't have current information on the attacker's velocity and vector. It was almost time to go. Actually, by mission parameters, it was past time. But Stockton knew the longer he waited, the better his final data would be. His squadrons would launch as soon as he transited back and gave the order, and they would move to the positions he transmitted. If everything went according to plan, the enemy ships would zip out of the transit point, through the minefield Eaton and Fritz had laid, and straight into 724 waiting fighters. The hegemony forces would be heavily battered before they got close to a Confederation battleship. Stockton was taking a chance with his strike force, gambling that the enemy truly did not have its own squadrons. Fully two-thirds of his wings were outfitted as bombers, a deadly wave of immense destructive capacity if his bet was right, and a mass of sitting ducks if those ships coming on were indeed loaded up with their own fighters. He looked back at the screens, checking the enemy ships as they got closer. His fighter wasn't as fast as an unmodified Lightning, he reminded himself. Don't cut this too close. He flipped a row of switches, powering up his reactor. He'd been operating on minimal power, doing as little as possible to draw attention to himself, but now it was time to get his engines online. He double-checked his course back to the transit point. Everything looked good. He did one last scan of the enemy fleet. Everything seemed unchanged. He'd already crunched the numbers and he had the orders ready to transmit to his squadrons, who were waiting in the launch bays for him to return and give the final command. He waited another few minutes, knowing he really was cutting it close. He didn't know the maximum acceleration of the hegemony ships, and all it would take was their equivalent of a Confederation fast escort racing forward to intercept his ship short of transit. Getting the latest data was important, but the risk-reward relationship was shifting. It was time. He pulled on the throttle, bringing his ship around to line up his engines along his course to the transit point. Then he pulled back, slowly at first, just until he confirmed his engines were back online and firing properly. He slammed the controls all the way back and felt the force of acceleration slam into him as his fighter blasted hard for the transit point. He didn't know if the enemy would pursue him or if they would change their plans based on his presence, but they were getting close to the point now. Even with their superior thrust capacity, they could only modify things so much. Stockton was confident he had what he needed to put a hurt on them as they emerged. He could see the wall of ships getting closer. For an instant, he thought several small vessels were accelerating toward him, but then he shook his head. They just repositioned themselves in the formation. He looked straight ahead as he neared the point, bracing himself for the transit. The move between systems was more unpleasant in the confines of a fighter, which lacked the heavy shielding of larger vessels. He took a few deep breaths as his ship approached, and then he held his breath as his fighter slipped into the strange alternate reality of the tube. The trip between systems only took a few seconds, but it seemed longer to Stockton, sitting there, trying to deal with the incomprehensible sensations of the strange space in the tube. The feeling wasn't pain, nor sickness, but it was decidedly uncomfortable, a sense of wrongness. Then, with a small flash of light, he emerged into the normal space of the Z-11 system. He shook his head, trying to banish the disorientation as he waited for his systems to reboot. He put his hand to the side of his headset, his fingers on the activation controls, waiting for the row of green lights that would tell him his ship and its comm systems were back online. The seconds passed, seeming longer for the tension he felt, the anxiety of the impending battle. Then he saw the lights flick on, and the displays on his panel came back to life. His finger pushed against the button on the headset's earpiece. "Dauntless Flight Control, this is Raptor. I'm transmitting the latest enemy nav information. I project entry into the system in 6 minutes, 20 seconds. A short pause, then. "Fleet order. All squadrons launch. Repeat, all squadrons launch." Atara lay back in the chair, her breath soft, shallow. She tried to get up twice, despite Weldon's strict instructions to stay where she was, and each time she'd fallen back into her seat, almost losing the contents of her stomach as the room spun around her. She'd insisted Weldon take. Her exact words were, as much blood as he could without outright killing her. The doctor had hesitated, insisting that it was dangerous to draw too much, but she reminded him that the lives of hundreds of their comrades depended on his producing as much serum as possible. And then she outright ordered him to do it. There just hadn't been any time to waste. Atara had been shocked at how quickly Weldon himself had recovered. The doctor had been deathly ill.